Hey everyone, today's episode talks a little bit about investment. And I think in all transparency, it's important that we give folks the disclaimer before we get things started, just to protect everybody legally. So with that, here is your quick disclaimer. All information discussed here, including any ideas, opinions, views, predictions, forecasts, commentaries, suggestions, or stock picks expressed or implied herein are informational, entertainment, for educational purposes only, and should not be construed as personal investment advice. While the information provided is believed to be accurate, it may include errors or inaccuracies. And with that, I think we will get started with this week's episode. So thank you so much. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Between Two Studs. I'm Alex Stud.
And I'm Ron Stud.
Ron, episode 14, my lucky number.
Yeah, we made it past an unlucky number to a lucky number. But that's not to say our last episode was bad by any stretch.
No, it was a great episode. But you know what? You're talking about luck. That's important because today we're going to be talking a little bit about money. We're going to be talking a little bit about finance.
Ooh, I'm invested.
You're invested into the conversation or you're financially invested into what?
A little bit of both. Why not? Right?
All right. All right. All right. Well, we can talk all about that. We have a good friend on the show today. Please welcome Mr. Tim Chubb. How are you doing tonight?
Awesome. Thanks, guys, for having me.
So, Chubb, I know you are a loyal follower of our show, so we're going to jump right into the fire round as you know it. Although – I came up with this on the last episode. I think this is more the ember round, right? It's stewing, right? It's very a slow burn. It's not rapid fire at all, which was the original purpose. But I enjoy the way this has been even more. So first question: how do you know us? What's the story?
Yeah, so you know, it's again, as I was sort of joking earlier, you know, it's weird calling you Alex and not Stud, because you know we met while we were in school together at Westchester University and during our undergrad and joined the Friars Society together. So we really, I guess, met each other late in our college careers when I think we're a little bit more mature people, or perhaps maybe just a little bit more. But you were a lot of fun to be around, and obviously naturally outgoing. And I think you know the Friars was an organization that talked so much about, you know, our values and the values of the fraternal, you know, society that we're becoming a part of, and how important the community was to all the brothers. And so I guess, you know, our values were aligned from day one. You know, I love how much you appreciated tradition and history, and you know, being part of the executive board. And I think at your AHL at the time, which I actually don't know what the A stands for, but I'm sure H is alumni. For historian. Alumni.
No, it was alumni honorary liaison.
Yeah. And so I just love the tradition and how much you honored it and how much you loved things that were done right and some that were done good and right, as opposed to the easiest way. And so anyway, just had an open mind and it was a lot of fun getting to know you. And I guess it was probably my junior year, your sophomore year, and then, you know, the senior year after it. So anyway, and I love the podcast, guys. I think that you guys are on to something here. It's been a lot of fun listening to it. I was going to say, Alex, you've got a face for radio, but Ron... Dude, you should do TV with Matt Toll, you know, so.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
That's fantastic. Well, it's funny. We've never talked about the Friars before on this podcast, although you're the second person who was in the Friar Society with me. It was a fraternity in college, and we were actually candidate brothers. We came in the same class. That's really, I mean, we definitely got to know each other very quickly because of that. So very cool. Appreciate the kind words.
Yeah, and I got to know, you know, Alex is the storyteller back then too, and so that's why it's been cool to see sort of how the podcast has evolved and you guys telling stories together. I mean, I probably could listen to you talk about anything, and I did for a long time after knowing you, and it's not in like a, you know, self-promotional way for either of you. You just are well-read and are passionate about things and hearing other people's thoughts, and so I hope you guys keep this up for a long time.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. Tell us a little bit more about some of your areas of interest, just kind of personal passions, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. So I live in Westchester, PA. So, you know, literally four blocks from where I met Alex with my wife, Amber. Grew up in Central Bucks County and right outside of Philadelphia. Studied economics and finance here and then got into the investment management industry, you know, immediately. So stayed in Westchester, got a job, fell in love, and here I am all these years later. Not to be cliche, my wife's my best friend, my life's business partner. She works in management consulting as a director of organizational change and strategy. So literally as me as an investor, I think I have ideas, a million ideas about how to make a business better. And she's in the making businesses better business. So that keeps things pretty spicy. and I promise I won't use bad language in the whole podcast, but you know, I really didn't get to know my wife until after school, after we graduated. And so as a result, she really didn't get to know Alex when I got to know Alex. And, you know, because we were a couple years apart, you know, Alex moved away and you know, up in Boston, everything, you know, the interactions have been more limited than I think all both of us would hope. But every time I'm talking to Alex on the phone or something, she, after I tell a story, she always goes, "I fucking love Stud." Every single time. And, you know, it's like, it just, you know, again, I appreciate how much she's, you know, gotten to know you in such a short period of time, but obviously it's something that Amber's probably gonna be blushing if she hears this, but, and probably wouldn't want me to tell the world, but she literally says it every single time. But anyway, I mean, outside of work, I'm a full blown Twitter addict. I'm on Twitter all day long, reading constantly all throughout the day, love playing golf and all that comes with it. Especially now with this new culture around golf course design and environmental sustainability with course management and destigmatizing country club culture. Having a lot of fun loving golf and walking and really, I guess, reintroducing myself back into the game. Huge hip hop fan, hip hop head. Spent a lot of years in my 20s actually trying to wiggle my way into a cameo of a music video.
I didn't know that. Were you successful?
No, but I was really close. Really close. I just wanted
there,
to be.
Was there a particular artist or you just wanted to be in a hip hop video?
You know, I love hip hop and so, you know, a lot of the, you know, thoughtful albums and, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about them and listening again and again, but I really just wanted to be in like the most stereotypical, gritty, grungy, just like hip hop album, like some Dirty South rapper that has got money and cars. And I just wanted to be part of that video for a split second. Just because how much I love hip hop. So I don't know.
Tim, you moved to the wrong city. You should be in Atlanta where Ron is.
I know.
You'd be all set here.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of Atlanta, I've got two Gucci Mane books. One's an autobiography and I can't recall the other one. I haven't read it yet.
Very nice.
Those were very kind words. I appreciate that, Tim.
Yeah.
But I will say another very important question as part of this round. I see you're currently drinking something. What are you drinking?
Yeah, so this is a double barrel Ben Pritchard's bourbon. Yeah, I found this bottle, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years ago and fell in love with it. So really tasty. And I'm a beer guy, but I really don't discriminate. I also like wine. I had a glass of white wine last night and weather warming up and had red wine all winter. So bourbon's usually my winter go-to, tequila in the summer, and then sort of just weave styles of beers throughout the year. So.
Yeah, I've always known you as a beer guy, but
yeah.
I like that you're drinking suburban tonight.
What are you guys sipping on? I learned about Malort thanks to you too after all these episodes now.
You need to come out to Chicago. Actually, you know what? I make a promise to you. Next time I'm in the Philadelphia area, I will bring out a bottle. I always get – it's funny. I've gotten to a point now because I've gotten so many people into it that every time I come out to the East Coast, I have to bring like 6 or 8 bottles.
I love it.
So cool. Next time I do a run, there's a bottle with your name on it.
Now, when you go walking through the store with all that Malort, do people just like look at you? I mean, like I can't imagine people are bringing like buying Malort in that quantity at a time.
Yeah, you know, so it's definitely a love-hate relationship. Like people, it's very polarizing here in Chicago. People either will see me with a case of Malort and be like, "Nice, dude. Like you're taking that and you're bringing, like you're going to make some people happy. Like you're taking that, like, you know, picking that up before you go on a road trip or something."
Yeah.
Or you have people who are like, "What is wrong with you?" There are definitely, there's a percentage of people in Chicago that they will only drink it as a prank to when other people are in town. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, "Oh, you're in town. Let's go to a bar. Oh, you got to have this drink." And they do it for the reaction. But I genuinely love the beverage, and I've gotten a lot of people hooked on it as well.
Yeah, that sounds good. It reminds me of like in Philly with the citywide special. Was a PBR and a shot of, boy, maybe Jim Beam? Can't remember.
That sounds right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and in Chicago, we have the equivalent. We call it a Chicago handshake, and that is a shot of Malort with an old style beer. An old style I've never found anywhere outside of Illinois either. Although Ron was just at a Chicago bar the other night where he found it. He found old style. But they didn't have Malort, so they're not really a Chicago bar in my mind. Old style is like a PBR, just so you know.
Yeah. And to be fair, old style was not on tap, despite what it said. It was canned.
Those liars.
But I did ask them. I was like, yeah, do you have any Malort? And they said, no. So I did talk to a manager at one point. And I said, you know, you could do a Chicago handshake if you had some Malort here. And he's like, well, do you like Malort? I said, yeah, I've got like 3 bottles back in my house, but they're getting emptied, especially with this podcast.
I bet you whoever owns the place, whatever, you know, they probably went up to the manager's office. I bet you there's a bottle, you know, half-drank bottle of Malort probably that they forgot about somewhere in a drawer.
For sure.
That sounds like the type of thing that you just forget about being in your office or something.
So you got some bourbon tonight. What about you, Ron?
So I'm also drinking some bourbon tonight. This is from my Infinity bottle. So, you know, I think we've talked to our guests a little bit about that before in the past. So it's a good mix of a lot of different things, but honestly tastes really good tonight. So very happy.
A quick recap on that is remind me, Ron, I believe it is you basically take the last little bits of all of your bottles when there's maybe 1 ounce left and you just put it into this master.
It's a little bit more nuanced than that. So like basically I have a decanter. So it's a decanter. And the thing with it too is like, yes, I will take some bottles that I'm just like, oh, I don't want to finish it. And, you know, so I've got conceivably molecules of this, all these different whiskeys mixed together. There are some times where it's like my decanter is maybe half full and I'm like, hey, you know what'd be great in there? Buffalo Trace. And I'll just fill it up with Buffalo Trace. So depending on what's going on, it's a mix. So I could never reproduce it if I wanted to, but it's the house special, so I'll go with that. And what about you, Alex? What are you drinking tonight?
Well, counted as 3 guys drinking bourbons tonight. I am drinking this is my first time having this beverage. It's a corn-based, almost I think it's 100% corn, bourbon called Corn Trooper. And it's surprisingly pretty smooth. I'm more of a rye guy generally, but I'm very much enjoying this. It's pretty potent though. It's 101 proof.
Very nice.
So for how high alcohol it is, it's pretty smooth is what I'm impressed with. So 3 guys drinking bourbon tonight.
I love it.
All right. Last question we always ask as part of this early round. Chubb, pick a piece of art of some type.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
That's a hard one. The first thing that comes to mind is really a book that I carry with me all the time, pretty much, is written by Ray Dalio, who's a famous investor. He wrote a book called Principles, and you know, talks about how good principles are effective ways with, you know, dealing with reality. And it really helped me, I think, you know, early in my career and early in, you know, my recent role when I, you know, was taking over as chief investment officer at a young age, you know, really figure it all out and design, you know, a business or a machine, I think, in the way that I thought was effective and it would be consistent in producing results, and also a culture that was built around, you know, consistency of producing results and having principles around that. But I definitely say the other one, you know, going back to my hip hop comment is an album called Damn by Kendrick Lamar. He actually won a Pulitzer Prize shortly after it was released. And it's some deep shit. I mean, there's a lot of biblical references, especially to the book of Jeremiah, which is definitely for another day. But the cool part about it is it's really 2 albums in one. And so, you know, when you listen to it from front to back, it's the allegory of a blind woman that Kendrick Lamar approaches, and the song ends with a gunshot. And, you know, she's trying to, you know, find something that she lost. And it's sort of implied throughout the album when you listen to it from the front to back about Lady Justice, and then she's the blind woman. And so, you know, it was released on Good Friday back in 2017, right after Donald Trump was elected president. And so a lot of questions related to whether our country is, you know, paying back taxes related to, you know, America's transgressions, examining, I think, our country during, you know, a time of extremism. So it was really relevant to me at that time when I was trying to figure a lot of things out with my political identity. And then when you listen to it in reverse, it's this contrast and duality of Kendrick Lamar, which was, you know, so, I guess, something I resonated so much with, especially when the album came out in the time of life that it was happening. I took over as chief investment officer back in 2017. And so he comes across looking for answers, realizes his faith is not enough. You know, it talks about it. There's a song called Duckworth, which is his last name. It's more autobiographical. And it asks this question, you know, what would destiny in his life or fate would have looked like if, you know, he didn't have what happened to him, especially related to his dad and ultimately Top Dog Entertainment's founder. And so I felt like there was a lot of correlation with my life with, you know, what would it have been had my dad not passed at a young age, as well as had I not met my wife. And so it's a fascinating album to listen to. Again, you can listen to it, you know, I'd say, you know, six times, you know, three front to back and back front, you know, and it's, you're still picking up things and storylines and I think analogies to life.
That's really interesting. I think what's amazing about certain works of art is especially the different levels of depth that the creators will often go to. It's one thing where you might listen to something or see something or read something where the first time it's like, yeah, that was a cool story. That was pretty cool. But when you go back with the repeated listens or views or watches, and then you pull those and then you can see like the allegory and you can see the various interwoven kind of dependencies within it. That's genius.
Well, what I think is really cool about that too. I'm not a hip hop guy, as you know, Tim, but what I think's cool is, you know, this is something I complain about a lot, you know, as a kind of an old fogey. So I talk about how music today, by and large, it's about these creations of 3 and 4 minute singles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no longer a story because people don't generally listen to an album cover to cover. And, you know, I'm so much of a classic rock guy and so is Ron. And so you listen to The Wall or Tommy, right? And there's a specific story beginning to end. And if you were to just listen to a particular song, you're missing the bigger point. So I'm glad that's a little bit of a resurgence, or at least in the case of this one album.
Yeah, you know, I think just like any music genre, there are hip hop artists that have a story to each album. And sometimes, you know, listening to that album, there'll be a song that'll be a hit and that'll be more popular and there's not as much depth to it, but it actually fits in with the whole story. And I think the beautiful part of music is really, you know, people can connect to it emotionally because of what they're going through, like I did with the back, like listening to the album in reverse. But it also is such a interesting glimpse of time. You know, typically talking about geopolitics and, you know, the issues that our country and our global, you know, the globe is facing at the moment. And that's why I love I can listen to it 10 years from now and it'll take me back to how I felt when Donald Trump was elected and what the country was going through for the last, you know, 4 years.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because Ron and I, we love music, but we haven't really talked about it much on our podcast. But I was actually going to comment exactly what you just said, which is, you know, when I've fallen in love with an album and you listen to it so many years later, it takes you right back to where you were when you first heard it. You know, and it's kind of peculiar. People always say the strongest sense is for associated with memory is smell. But hearing's got to be right up there. I mean, I know for me, every time I hear Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, I think of sitting in the car in the back seat while my dad is driving down the road and we were driving around in Western New York, because that was the first time I ever heard the album. And to this day, if I hear a track off of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, I that's what I think about. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I feel like I'm the same way where, you know, they say, you know, I've heard that, you know, the sense of smell, but for me, it's always been music and hearing things and, you know, associating like life's experiences with music. You know, I can remember the song I was playing and the woman who drove me home from high school after my dad passed away, you know, some, you know, Beach Boys song. And you know, I have a hard time remembering faces and an easy time remembering names. And so I think that's probably part of it is I just for whatever reason, I can read things, I can hear things, I can remember words and names and dates. Isn't your birthday June 14th, by the way?
It is. That's impressive.
Yeah. I've got a weird thing with remembering birthdays. And so, you know, maybe that's part of it too. And why I connect to music so much is just how my brain ticks. Flag day.
Wait. Can I guess? Your birthday is like June 9th or 10th, right?
It's the 8th. And you also share a birthday with Trump.
I know. You know what's funny is I know this is totally a tangent, but when I was younger, you know, you'd look up your birthday and it was like a celebrity that you share your birthday with. And mine was always Donald Trump. And of course, when you're, you know, 8, 9 years old, it was a totally different time period. And I was like, oh, that guy, like, that's cool.
Yeah, he's on the movies. Yeah.
Right. He was in Little Rascals, right? And
Right.
he was in Home Alone 2.
Yeah.
And then, oh, he's the apprentice guy. And then, yeah, now I don't exactly brag about the celebrity I share my birthday with.
So mine's Kanye West. So I kind of feel your pain. I mean, he's brilliant, but you know, people are divided on how they feel about Kanye.
So Chubb, thank you so much. You got us through the Ember round as Alex has recoined it. So now we're going to get into our career, finance, and just kind of general interests. Early in your career, you became the CIO or the chief investment officer of a company with over 4 billion in total assets under management. You're in 3 years now. What's a day in your life look like?
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of what it was before, to be honest, which is I think the most fun part about the job is, you know, you can be an investor and have interest in the markets and discretion over people's money, and it's really just one of those like lifelong jobs. And you start out when you're, you know, young and hopefully in, you know, contributing role as a as an analyst, and you know, want to work your way up to ultimately, you know, run the firm. But I feel luckily like I found like this is a I guess a career for me. I found something that doesn't feel like work. And you know, for years and sometimes today, you know, I really don't think about anything else besides, you know, the markets and how they may impact certain things impacted. And it's sort of, it gets into your DNA. And I think, you know, there's very few things in life where the world intersects into, you know, the capital markets, from politics and policy and technology and healthcare and, you know, just the finances of a country and how everything is interconnected. And so, you know, it's a lot of fun doing anything less, you know, and sort of the way that I'm doing it makes me feel really frustrated and ineffective. And so ultimately, I think the most fun part is, you know, being in I guess my role now, you know, as I feel like I'm a GM, I'm the coach, I'm the player on the field. And that relates to, you know, building the team, having the process put in place, leading research on one project, but sort of being part of, you know, the team on another one and not necessarily, you know, driving it. And so I think it's really helpful to have a culture of vigorous debate. And when I joined my firm, Girard, you know, pre-acquisition of a publicly traded bank called Univest Financial Corporation, I just fell in love with the culture. And that really translated into, you know, me being here as for as long as it has, and also what attracts me sometimes to a business that we're investing in. And I guess the cool part, you know, that I often use as like a metaphor for the culture is, you know, we used to get together in this lunchroom at a minimum every Friday. We, you know, buy lunch for the firm. And at the time there was like 12 to 15 of us, you know, we all fit in there comfortably. And every Friday, you know, we just basically debate politics, the economy, the markets, policy, you know, and tons of laughing. And you sometimes, you know, we got into disagreements with people and they would sort of go off and have their own side conversation, which always, you know, was really interesting. But I think it ultimately helped foster a culture of being able to come into my office, someone sit down with me, tell me I'm wrong, and be able to do that to the CIO of a firm and sometimes change my mind. And so, you know, I guess that's why I love my job. It allows me to be curious and be drunk with ideas and have a lot of smart people to bounce things off of. And so I just think a lot of times in life you can just have success by giving a shit. So, you know, for me, I care a lot about our clients. I care a lot about our research and the team that I work with. And so, you know, I think our culture at our firm's great. And you know, ultimately, doing research is what I started my career doing, and what I'm doing now. It's just a little bit different with titles, so it's very much the same.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was going to ask you, and you brought it up. There's so many variables that are taking shape when you're thinking about markets and you're thinking about the economy and of course geopolitical situations and this little pandemic that showed up last year. You know, I'm really curious. There must be occasions where you have your team, and there's a discussion about whether your business should make an investment one way or the other into this particular, and you know, whatever type of investment it is. And there's this disagreement by your lieutenants, and you, I would assume, have to make the final call. And in a lot of cases, you're talking about the difference of millions of dollars. I mean, how that can't be easy.
Yeah, no. So, you know, I think it goes back to the book principles. It goes back to how you build the firm. And so when I came on board and took over in my role, we decided that we wanted this organization that was built through acquisition that had all these different lines of business managing money from, you know, municipal pension plans to private wealth to, you know, corporate retirement plans, that all the smart people that are doing investment research should all be talking with one another, which I think makes logical sense. But it all goes back to how you build the structure from a voting perspective. And so we have one investment committee and it has seven people. I have one vote. Sometimes I'll be the flip vote, but sometimes I'm not. My vote counts just as much as everybody else's. And we have all these other, you know, research committees that are related to individual stock research and outside managers and, you know, how we view economic environment. And all those teams have five voting members and I'm on two of them. And sometimes I'm the deciding vote and sometimes I'm not. And so ultimately consensus rules. And I think with that, you come at ideas in a different way. And ultimately, I think respect each other's opinions a lot more because ultimately you don't know who in the room is going to be the deciding vote. And so, yeah, it's a lot of pressure and a lot of, you know, sometimes you have sleepless nights when you're trying to figure things out. But it all goes back to team and having, I think, this decentralized and democratic process that has yielded a lot of success with us, in particular within the last 3 or 4 years.
Love it. Hey, Tim, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, one of the reasons I had you on the show was because I have a lot of friends who have reached out to me and said, hey, Alex, Wall Street Bets, everyone's talking about it. I really don't understand the shorting and why, you know, these people, are they villains? Are they good? And I wanted to bring you on because I knew you could explain it for a layman. And I know Ron has an interest in the conversation as well. So we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about that.
If you're all the way through your last binged podcast and looking for something new, then Foundation Radio has you covered. Interviews, politics, beer drinking, pro wrestling, Dungeons and Dragons, we have something for everyone. Stream the new episodes every Tuesday wherever you find your favorite podcasts. You can find all of our archive at foundationradio.net. You can also follow us on Instagram at @foundation_radio. Foundation Radio, something for everyone.
Enjoying yourself some Between Two Studs? Well, I know I am. Well, good news. If you want to reach out to us, we've got ourselves a new email address, between@twostuds.com. Send us an email, and who knows, maybe we'll read your letter on the air. Talk to you soon.
All right, and we're back. And as I was alluding to before we went to break, you know, one of the reasons I really wanted Tim Chubb on was to talk about this whole Wall Street Bets phenomenon, this movement, whatever you want to call it, that's taking place right now. Tim, can you quickly just, so everyone has the same level set, explain what it is, what happened in January, and what's still continuing to happen right now?
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack, but you know, I think that the essence of you know how things started was this. I think gamification of trading and investing and the adoption of social media ultimately impacting the capital markets for the first time in a meaningful way. And so, you know, in the first part with Robinhood, and not to disparage them in particular, but we've seen, I think, a lot of, you know, sort of gamification of trading and a lot of this, you know, discussion around talking around, you know, a narrative or a specific theme within the market. And ultimately that becomes the entirety of the investment thesis, as opposed to really diving into the fundamentals of the company. But ironically, you know, there was this person on this Wall Street Bets subreddit called Roaring Kitty, who started posting fundamental research about GameStop. And, you know, as they were doing so, ultimately the, you know, stock actually continued to fall and plummet, and the dollars behind the people who are following that person's, I guess, due diligence in doing some of their own, I'm sure, ultimately weren't doing well. But eventually this sort of mob mentality formed where on the subreddit and other social media, people decided that they wanted to sort of screw Wall Street in a way that Occupy Wall Street didn't do in a sense. And it was this really, I guess, fascinating attack and sort of, you know, Wall Street got some of its own medicine, especially some of the hedge funds. And so what happened when all these traders, and I don't call them investors, because I think the people who, you know, led to what happened back in late January were really speculators and traders, whereas you think Roaring Kitty is obviously an investor for a variety of reasons. But ultimately, these people piling on to the company and buying shares and also compounding that with options created some significant issues for the market's plumbing. And it ultimately created the most epic short squeeze that we have seen in quite some time. And so when a company is short, when an investor is short a company, it means they're betting on the stock to go down. And to do so, they borrow shares from somebody else to, basically, short. And that person lends it out and there's a fee that's involved with the short. And so when a firm or a company's, shares are all lent out to such a degree that GameStop and others like it were, then when good news is announced, such as, GameStop or any other company reporting some positive news, the people who are short have to cover their short. They buy the stock to stop their loss. And that sort of creates this snowball where price keeps going up because people are needing to cover. And then the algorithmic trading and momentum just takes hold. And sometimes you see these significant moves in the stock price. And so, we saw GameStop go from, not a lot to
you said it was like $3 to like $4.50 in a couple of days, right?
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, there's hedge funds that were just absolutely hemorrhaging assets. But what happened was it turned into a story of, hey, the plumbing of the financial system and how trading works, the because of the way things are settled from a trade, a share perspective, it's clogging the pipes. And there were some significant issues that we saw from a liquidity perspective that resulted when ultimately this happened in late January. So yeah, it was one of the most interesting things I've ever experienced in my career. And I've had a lot of fun watching it and in many ways rooting on the retail investor, because this concept of a short squeeze is something that hedge funds, try to do the other firms and participate in for years. It was just basically a problem because a bunch of people who weren't doing research and were just trading and speculating were doing it, who quote unquote didn't have any investment expertise or really fundamental research supporting the company.
So just to make sure I've got that correct, folks who are in it for quote the tendies, that's not typical for most investors.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I think, there's people are sitting at home, a new generation of investors is sitting at home. They have apps on their phones. The system's been gamified. And as a result of all that taking place, you have a lot of speculation taking place in the market. And it's been in both stocks and also crypto assets to an extent. But, there's a lot of people out there, again, like you said, a lot of institutional money like me, pension funds and the like that, invest in these companies for serious purposes backed by research. For full disclosure, I do not own GameStop, haven't owned GameStop, and we haven't recommended it as a firm or any of the other major companies like an AMC that were part of that. But ultimately, I guess the financial media and the guy, the man, I guess, the Wall Street man, really didn't take kindly to the game being played on them like it was.
We kind of talked about this beforehand, so I admit I have a little bit of stake in that personally. But, I guess what's kind of interesting is you sort of see some very mixed messaging from kind of the establishment, if you will. Because on the one hand, you have a lot of kind of media presentations saying, hey, everyone's kind of out of the shorting business with this. And you've kind of got this speculative kind of snowball where you've got a lot of people just throwing into it. And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If everybody believes it's, there's some kind of value or something going on, it's like the tulip mania. Yep. But, to the layman, why is this not like your typical tulip mania? Or is there maybe something what's your kind of take on it, if you will?
Yeah, I haven't done and completed, deep fundamental research on GameStop and what we believe, the shares would be worth. But when you invest in stocks, like we do, we believe in that long term, the fundamentals of the business will ultimately drive the value of the company.
Well, that ultimately is the intrinsic value that your firm or other firms or even individuals would say, we believe this company is worth X, right?
Exactly. And so, a lot of thoughtful analysis goes into that. What is the total addressable market of how that company's service or product could potentially expand? is it something that's cross borders and ultimately becomes a global product, or is it something that really will just be domestic due to, you know, the taste of a specific country? And so there's a lot of thoughtful analysis that goes into basically the cash flows that ultimately drive the value of the stock. And cash flows, you know, typically profits or revenue, and the expectation of what that'll grow like over time. And, you know, not to make this into like an investing class, but, you know, time value of money suggests that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. And so you discount those projections of operating profits as or revenues or cash flows, you know, back to today. The sum of those cash flows discounted to today is the intrinsic value of a business. And so it's the same with, you know, if you're investing in bonds or real estate, private company. I mean, that's the concept that drives the capital markets. And so, you know, when people bet on a stock to go up, they really don't care about the underlying business. To them, it's just, you know, in GameStop's case, you know, four numbers with a decimal point between the two of them and three letters. And they really don't care about whether or not it's GameStop or this company or that company. They just want it to go up in value. And so that's why they're speculators. That's why they're traders. They look at charts and the reversion of the mean and volatility and all these sorts of things to help attribute you the value in the short term. But what Roaring Kitty was doing and others like him, and it is a him, his name's Keith Gill. And ultimately, you know, he did fundamental research on the company. He believed it. He posted his research just as I could and posting on a blog or Reddit myself. And that's kind of the fun part about the financial markets and maybe why I'm addicted to Twitter so much is there is a lot of people managing billions and billions of dollars on Twitter and social media who are anonymous. And I'm one of them. And it's really fun to interact with that community because no one knows who you are. And you can really speak freely, especially when debating ideas when it comes to the markets and the economy.
It's interesting, your explanation, and I appreciate you doing that. It's difficult to know with 100% certainty how everyone who bought GME, what their motivation was. But I'll say from what I could tell as someone who made no investment and no transactions with GME, it seemed like it was less about trying to make money and it was more about making a point to screw over hedge funds.
Yeah. Yeah, it was sort of Occupy Wall Street all over again, but actually this one hurt. And I think it called in the question how the system's designed, who it benefits, and in a way that I very much agree with and align with. And I think the other piece that really is interesting for me is it exposed the financial system. It exposed the pipes and the plumbing, the issues that we have from a settlement perspective, and why I think blockchain technology ultimately is a solution. And you know, I know I'd love to talk about crypto if we get to it, but you know, for me, that was really the first time I went, this is where blockchain makes sense. Maybe not Bitcoin, but blockchain protocols are going to change the way the financial markets work and prevent the plumbing clog to ever happen again like it did today.
You know, and we will definitely get to blockchain and crypto. Don't you worry about that. But I guess my other question, because you kind of talked about Robinhood earlier, and you talked about the gamification element that allows for these, as you call them, just traders. These are not investors, they're traders. You know, do you see that as potentially a good thing? Is it strictly dangerous, or is it somewhere in the middle where, yes, it's a good thing, but we need to make some regulations or we need to change the system to adapt to this new style of transacting?
Yeah, I think it's all the above. You know, I think from an investor perspective, I believe in free and fair markets, and I think the democratization of the markets is really important, and the ability for people to access, you know, and to invest and improve their financial, hopefully standing, you know, and grow for the long term and meet their goals and objectives is really important. So, you know, one of the things that's really, so again, I guess in that context, you know, Robinhood's a free app for people to transact and buy stocks, you know, and there's other ways that they make money, but what these companies do, because now trading costs for stocks have gone to zero. I mean, you know, back long ago, you know, stocks were quoted in eighths and 30 seconds and 64ths because, you know, we couldn't handle, you know, technology couldn't handle like going down to the penny, and the cost to transact in stocks has gone down to now zero. And so, okay, if you're not paying for something, are you the customer or are you the product? In the same way that Facebook and Instagram are. And by the way, you know, I own Facebook. We recommend it as a firm. But if the service is free, then you are the product. And that is what I think a lot of these customers, quote unquote, of Robinhood have become. They are the product for Robinhood, and the person who wants to use them as a product is, you know, firms out there that do a lot of trade execution. And so it's a consequence of ultimately democratization of finance and the basically the race to zero from a fee perspective. So I think there's a lot to work on here, you know, more, again, away from the plumbing, but also, you know, proper education on you know, what the risks are to speculating the way that they have, to, I think, really looking at the incentives and who controls much of the financial system and how interrelated they might be. And perhaps there's some conflicts of interest that, you know, I think are worth looking into.
Really good answer. So one of the interesting things that I think I was exposed to personally with working with JP Morgan was the intricate world of credit default swaps. And for our guests or listeners, rather, credit default swaps at a high level are they're financial instruments that are used to kind of basically, they're supposed to be used for hedging, right? So the idea is that, let's say, I don't know, I'm a steel manufacturer, I work with Boeing. I've got a $300 million transaction with Boeing, but Boeing has had a bad year. They're not able to pay for that transaction. They've actually gone under. You, as whoever might be the recipient of my credit default swap, agrees to accept a small fee for paying for that in case that it's basically you're paying it for insurance, if you will. So that if Boeing is unable to pay for it because they go under, you would assume that debt and you would pay me for that. So where I'm kind of going with that is I kind of wonder, in looking at what happened with GameStop, specifically with hedge funds, there was definitely some weird announcements where it was like, hey, so-and-so has agreed to provide $8 billion in funding for X hedge fund. I kind of wonder, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sure most of these organizations love just providing loans to each other. How much of that may have been associated with trying to prevent a credit default swap from kicking in?
Yeah, the concept of counterparty risk was definitely a concern. You know, I thought that one of these custodians would not exist anymore unless they got funding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're especially, you know, when you're buying and selling a stock, you know, those transactions are supposed to be instantaneous, right? It takes 2 days to settle. But if I want to sell a share of a company to you, Ron, or you, Alex, you know, that's a pretty clean transaction. But the problem where things really got out of hand with this whole sort of, you know, meme stock mania was really with the options market. And so again, it's a little inside baseball, but you know, they were buying these call options. A call option is basically this levered bet because one contract is 100 shares that a company, a financial instrument can, you know, basically exceed a certain value. And that value could be, you know, $5. And basically it's a bet on expectation of where a stock will go in the short term. And so people buy contracts and say, okay, I expect this company to go to 100 and I'm willing to pay $5 for that bet that it'll go to 100 because I expect it actually to go to 110 and my contract will be worth a lot because I'll be able to buy those shares at 100 and sell them at 110 in the open market. And so, you know, that's the concept of a call option. Well, someone's got to sell that option. Someone's going to go out there and say, yeah, GameStop, it'll never get to 400. You can pay me $1 per share, so $100 per contract, and you can make that bet. And when people made that bet, a lot of people who were selling those calls ran into serious financial trouble, and it created something, you know, we call a counterparty risk, which, you know, if you watch The Big Short, the movie, yeah. I mean, that's why everybody was sad at the end, because they were worried that they had bought these credit default swaps, these CDS instruments to basically bet against these mortgage-backed securities. And when the person who provided that insurance, quote unquote, couldn't pay for it and couldn't pay the claim, you know, what's the value of an asset or a contract that someone can't pay for? Zero. So even though you were smart and you made the bet, you lost all your money because the other person couldn't pay up.
I have one last question about this subject. You know, you're talking about the pipes and just the infrastructure to support the massive amount of transactions that were occurring. You know, Robinhood in particular got a lot of flack because they halted trading. And there were a lot of rumors that circulated that said, well, they are in bed with these hedge funds. They don't want people to be making purchases to continue to drive up the price of GameStop and AMC because they are also losing tons of money. They gave an explanation that talked about some limitations with being able to finance those transactions and some of the piping that you're talking about. Was their response 100% accurate to the best of your knowledge? I mean, obviously not being a member of Robinhood, or was there some questionable, you know, I wasn't fully satisfied with their answer?
I am fully satisfied with their answer to my knowledge. They, from a collateral perspective, absolutely had to post billions of dollars in order to, you know, prevent, you know, some serious issues from happening with, you know, I believe, you know, if it were to continue to compound and grow, ultimately it was a question of, you know, would they go under? And in that case, you know, there's really not much of consequences, you know, as it relates to the investor, because there's lots of insurance that exists on all these sorts of things. But, you know, I think, as far as, you know, what they were saying, as far as the collateral that they need to post it, you know, the reasons that they needed to basically not allow people to buy something anymore. And it was only, you know, I've never seen anything like it in my life, but the buying would have created bigger issues and it would have just continued to compound to the extent where I wouldn't say it would put the entire financial system at risk, but it definitely created a lot of instability that week or two. And ultimately, you know, it was a very crowded trade. You know, the concept of having 140% of the shares outstanding available to short was a problem. Who knew? I mean, like, I never even knew that was possible. It's sort of like when oil went to -$40 a barrel this time last year. It was like, why can oil contracts go to -40? Well, that's the cost of storage and like storing oil. So you're learning, you know, you learn a lot going through a global pandemic and managing money. And I feel like we've been through like the global financial crisis plus, you know, tech bubble, pretty much all in 12 months.
So as a final question about this, and then I know Ron also has a question, but in your mind, to the best of your knowledge, like I know people who personally have said, I'm done with Robinhood. I'm not going to use Robinhood anymore. Do you think that's a little unfair?
It's unfair because they had to do what they did, full stop. I mean, I can't speculate on if there was other ulterior motives, but I know what they said was accurate. I believe it was accurate, ultimately, from a financial perspective. And, you know, I think they had to do it.
So, Chubb, I guess the big takeaway, you know, ultimately there was the congressional hearing. There was a lot of news, a lot of different things going on. And I know that part of what you do for a living is ensuring that people feel that investing is a safe place to, you know, have that long-term growth that they desire. Do you feel like this is ultimately going to be viewed as something that was a net positive? Or do you think that this just really was an alarm bell that maybe things needed to kind of, folks needed to wake up to it?
I think it was both. You know, I think there was people who got hurt in all this, which, you know, I think was inevitable when you see the amount of people who hadn't had much investing experience gambling and speculating on a company like that. Again, it's not for me to say that I don't think it's not worth more than it is today. I'm not suggesting that at all. But there are people out there, and I think the business did get ahead of itself as far as what the valuation was concerned. And so, you know, people were hurt from that. But I do think it's net positive in the sense that I think it pulled back the curtain on the clogs and the financial plumbing. I think it also educated a new generation of investors on how, you know, sort of the game is played. I came out on social media and on the media and said, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game. And I think that concept proves true for a lot of reasons. It's, you know, this is what hedge funds have done and they've done it for a long time. And so this is the game that is played. And when you lose money like you did and not measure, you know, or I guess bet or speculate that, you know, and use too much of your money to do so, it's going to become a problem. And so, you know, I think it pulled back the curtain. I think it educated a new generation of investors. And I think ultimately, you know, we saw, you know, some things from a regulatory standpoint that need to be resolved. And I'm hopeful that, you know, we'll see some action soon here as a result of all this. I don't think anyone needs to go to prison, right? But I think, and again, it's like no one went to prison from the, you know, I guess global financial crisis to a large extent, but there's got to be some regulatory change. And I'm all for free and fair markets. But, you know, I don't think that's exists right now with the way things are currently structured.
Makes sense. I have to say, well, Chubb, this has been great. Alex and I have kind of decided we're going to do something really special for you. We've just got a lot kind of already kind of brewing with what we're discussing. And I think what we're thinking to do, Alex, if you're in agreement with me, I think we're going to make this a two-parter. What do you think, Alex?
There's too much more to talk about.
There's so much financial investment wisdom here. We're going to stop with this right here. And then we're going to continue on a separate episode, continuing with Mr. Timothy Chubb. So thank you so much.
We will see everyone on. This is part one. And part two will be the continuation of this conversation.
Stay tuned to next week's episode for the thrilling conclusion of our interview with Tim Chubb, How the Game is Played.